We bring you analysis of the legislative session that was and a hint or two about what's to come. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, March 19th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome SDPB's Lee Strubinger. We'll check in with the state's felony ingestion reform for controlled substances. And we will search for clues about lawmaker priorities when economic development clashes with social issues. Kevin Wooster and Brad Jurgensen offer analysis for today's Dakota Political Junkies. We'll discuss a state government reset and what really matters when it comes to a governor's spending. Plus, Bob Mercer of Keloland News joins us for a look at 40 years in Pierre, including the day he wanted to walk away from it all. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We have been connecting for about 40 days with SDPB's politics and public policy reporter, Lee Strubinger from Pierre. Well, now he is with us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City, where you get to return to your home base. Hey, Lee, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Let's talk a little bit about something that we're going to hear more about this hour from the Dakota Political Junkies, which is the state's felony ingestion penalty. You covered it before the session. You covered it this session. Help us remember where those penalties stood or where that law stood prior to 2025's legislative session.
Prior to, still currently, the state has a felony level charge for basically possession of a controlled substance through ingestion. So you might not have the physical controlled substance in your pocket or on you, but if you are drug tested and you test hot for certain controlled substances, that could result in a felony level charge. And so it's a very unique law that South Dakota has. We're the only one in the country that has it. And so there have been efforts basically since I've started over 8 years ago to reform this felony level charge. It was a Democratic idea. A lot of Democrats brought this reform or to kind of change that law. And then some Republicans picked up on it. And then finally this year, the idea was sort of reworked a little bit and it passed and the governor signed it without much announcement that he was going to sign it. It was just kind of included in an email of bills that he signed. But yeah. It's kind of a big deal.
So what were some of the previous arguments against this? Because what I'm trying to figure out, is it just the right time, the right piece of legislation that over years built to like, okay, now we know what will pass. So take us back to what the previous arguments against this were.
The previous arguments against it were basically that, and this is a phrase that gets used a lot in the state capitol building, but mm-hmm. that this law was basically one of the tools in the toolbox for law enforcement and prosecutors when dealing with cases like this. Like typically, if drugs are involved, something else might also be involved in a particular case. And so this is one of those kind of charges that prosecutors can bring to sort of work with folks who have broken the law to get some sort of charge on the books or some kind of prison sentence mm-hmm. To sort of add to that. So it's one of those things that law enforcement really has argued against changing in the past because it's something that they utilize in the court system.
So why now? What happened this year that was different?
I would say a couple things happened that were different. So typically on average, there are about, in both men's and women's prisons here in South Dakota, about 200 people total in prison on average, it fluctuates, whose highest level charge is this felony level ingestion. Obviously, a lot of the talk in the last few years has been the lack of services in our prison system due to overcrowding. And so this is kind of one of those quick measures that lawmakers saw that could change or help reduce the amount of people in the state's prison system currently. The other thing that was different is that this bill takes a little bit different of an approach to the ingestion law. It would still ultimately end up as a Class 6 felony, but that would be only after your third ingestion charge within a 10-year time period. Mm-hmm. So your first two violations of ingestion will be a class one misdemeanor. And when you are charged with that, you are ordered, the judge has to order that person complete a drug and alcohol evaluation mm-hmm. and complete supervised probation using evidence-based sentencing practices. Think like the HOPE program and other probationary programs. The second charge is basically similar, but that they have to complete any other recommended course of treatment that they get for that second violation. And then the third obviously would be that class six felony, which could result in some prison time.
Yeah. All right. Before I let you go, a quick pivot to something else, because one of the things that stuck with me, one of the quotes, I guess you would call it, that stuck with me from the previous legislative session was Representative Will Mortensen, who worked on Senate Bill 201. And I remember him telling me, like, I hope we don't become a state where things are no longer built. And when I watched the news come out of this legislative session, that tension between economic development and social issues and what Republicans would prioritize also struck me. I'm wondering if there are any comments or moments or scenes from this year's session that maybe will stick with you going forward.
Yeah, I think there was kind of along that vein, but maybe sort of on the opposite side of the Republican spectrum is a quote that I heard from Republican Representative Bethany Soy, who is a majority whip, which is like kind of a part of leadership within the House Republican caucus. And it was during the consideration of whether or not to override the governor's veto on the child care grants. And I think when we think about economic development and a lot of the other issues that were circulating around the legislative session, this quote really stuck out to me in particular. And here it is right now.
Listening to both the letter from the governor and the debate here on the floor, I've heard two words used over and over again. Workforce, 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 economic development, economic development, economic development. What is missing from this debate? What is best for the child? Are we going to talk about that at all? You know, not just this bill, but there's a lot of others where we're just focusing on workforce, 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 workforce. What is best for the child?
Part of the reason that this particular quote stuck out to me is because in addition to all the issues that lawmakers are looking at, one of the kind of overarching one is property tax. And this year in committee and in press conferences, you even had the House Majority Leader Scott Odenbach questioning even whether or not the growth that Sioux Falls has seen has been good for that community, specifically under the lens of this kind of property tax issue where property taxes have gone up really high due to a kind of increased demand in services. So you kind of have this new Republican majority that is maybe skeptical of the development that the state has really pushed for over the last several years. And then let's think about what occurred, you know, earlier this week with Governor Larry Roden kicking off this kind of economic development tour that he's doing statewide and really highlighting the kind of business growth that the state is seeing. So I think there's kind of this tension that we're going to be seeing play out over the next year as we head into this kind of second year of this new legislature getting its footing and moving forward.
Yeah. SDPB's Lee Stribinger, thank you so much. We appreciate the update.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. You heard SDPB's Lee Stribinger recapping the 2025 session just before the break. We turn now to our Dakota political junkies for their analysis. First, we'll talk about a few bills that surprised them. That includes one that removed the felony for ingestion of controlled substances. Plus, was this session a true reset? Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen is co-host of Dakota Town Hall podcast, and Kevin Wooster is a longtime South Dakota journalist who has reported for the Argus Leader, the Rapid City Journal, Keloland News, and SDPB, to name just a few. We start here with Kevin Wooster.
First of all, I was struck by the fact that they actually, you know, took the ingestion felony away from meth.
Yeah, did not see that on my
bingo card. Is that amazing?
It did not see it. Then it didn't see it even being signed without a fight, really. That's a good point.
And it went to Rodin, and Rodin signed it. I mean, it was stunning, and I think wise. And not everything they did this session was wise, of course, but that I didn't see. I was extremely happy, as you might imagine, that they put the vindictive destruction of the SDPB budget back in the... salvaged it from the
Full price for my equipment now.
Somebody that for some reason just decided it was time to wreck SDPB.
SDPB funding fully restored. Thank you, listeners.
Great.
Good job, legislator.
Good job, people that got involved. And, I think Tony Van Huysen was talking about a perfect example of how that system works out there when people show up and legislators listen and do the right thing. So that was good. And the library funding came back,
Not all of it, but most of it.
And they did a lot better than it looked like they might do initially.
Yeah.
And I was very happy that we decided we're not going to put librarians in prison because a stray copy of Catcher in the Rye ends up in the wrong hands. That was exciting.
Exciting. It was so exciting.
Because that was kind of it's odd. And here I'm a Catholic school dad. My kids went to Catholic school, the Gorman. Hey, those girls. How about the girls over the weekend? and I'm always happy when the vouchers go down because I was thrilled to send my kids to Catholic school and pay the tuition, and I was thrilled to keep paying my property taxes for public education because, guess what? I'm a citizen. Amazing, huh? What a thought. Yeah.
So that you're referring there to the education savings accounts is what we heard a lot about at the beginning of the session, and those were defeated. They did not make it through to the end. Yeah,
which was, again, a really wise thing. Could you call this session the session of the big no in a lot of ways, I suppose?
It's getting advertised as the reset.
Yeah?
Right.
Is that the same thing?
I see that on the executive level, but I think it's the only way it applies.
Uh-huh.
There was 20 bills killed on the House floor. That's a lot of bills. That tells a listening audience that there is no harmony between the committee leadership and the floor. That's a hostile way to run a house, even for the House.
Yeah,
that's saying a lot.
And that being said, the House was the calming voice of reason this year compared to the Senate. I don't even know how that works.
So let's go back to what you said about that's not the way to, it means there's probably more than one way of looking at that. The bills killed on the House floor could indicate a lack of coordination between the committee's leadership and the House proper. Also, someone could argue more things got heard, more things got discussed, more things were sent to the full body, and there's something good about that. Or what the heck is a committee for? So there's more than one way to look at it. And you're pointing out that that's highly unusual at the very least.
Well, I mean, I hear you that more issues might get heard on the floor in theory, but there's so much room for committee. You know, that's where you prep a bill for primetime. And I see a lot of leadership going back home and bragging about some issues. And I'm not trying to pick on Scott Odenbach, but what bill did he prime sponsor that got passed? They dropped the ball on education on their voucher deal. We're celebrating it as wins, but I look at it as they just couldn't get it home.
So they had to contend, Kevin, with a new governor and a changeover. And then, the budget address or the budget proposal that Kristi Noem had, Larry Rodin said, we're going to go forward with the same budget proposal. So they had to work with a whole bunch of new lawmakers, a new governor. The outgoing governor's budget, going forward as is, there was a lot to contend with in a really short period of time. How do you define reset, Kevin? What does it mean to reset? Or does it just mean that nothing happened? Well, we can't say nothing happened. I don't think that would be fair.
And I wasn't close enough to do anything other than talk to some people that were and get an impression. But the new members, a lot of whom got beat, and you probably discussed this before, in part because of that eminent domain issue and the carbon pipeline, the new members seem to align themselves pretty quickly with what you would call the hard right. If there was a mainstream Republican body left there, it seemed to leave the building. And as Murdoch says, things got a little chaotic, and things tend to get a little mean-spirited sometimes out there. And I I think that's a good point about the committee system. I mean, my wife just wrote something for Searchlight on a bill passed removing the law preventing concealed weapons in bars. Needless to say, she was not a big fan of that. Because
she does work with Moms Demand.
She does work with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Yeah, okay. So she's got a side on that fight. But that came through, and it was one of those bills, and that's nothing new. Bills end up, you got two-thirds, you can do anything at any time pretty much out there. And no committee hearings. Getting back to what Murdoch said, just at the end, here it goes, it's passed. And kind of a big issue. Kind of some bar owners might want to weigh in on it. Some people might want to weigh in on it. But you got two-thirds, you can do anything you want to, pretty much. And there should have been. And a lot of times there should have been. I'm getting back to what Murdoch said. That's a process that really needs to be followed in everything except a legitimate emergency.
It only works if it works, right? Yeah. It's like you got to use it.
Yeah. And were the people there now, you probably know better than I do, are they the kind of people that could make that work?
I mean, I guess that's left to be said when you see them enter their second year. Right. And this isn't just the hard right. This is any first time, you kind of usually the first time legislators kind of learn the ropes and learned in committee. And this is how a committee works. And now a lot of them come loaded for bear with 10 or 12 more bills. And committee hearings are a meandering process, an obstruction, if anything, Yeah.
Hmm. So the second year, you think, will be different for them as they get their feet under. I mean, I heard that a lot, that there was a lot of, throughout interviews and conversations in the hallway in Pierre, there was a lot of, well, we just need to slow down and see what the process is. We need to talk about it a little. There was a lack of understanding of what the process was because so many people were new. And there was a new education piece that had to happen, which is not out of the ordinary. It would be very hard to get that many people spun up into how everything works, and then hit the ground running on day one with every lawmaker who came in, especially if they primaried somebody on one issue that was very important to them.
But even leadership had some, tread off the tires. And I would remember speaking with Senator Duhamel early in the session, because senators were waiting for committee hearings. They just weren't, week after week, they weren't getting processed out. That was for the first time in, I guess, I don't know how long.
Okay.
Yeah. And she didn't get a leadership spot, right? She ran, but didn't get it, which tells you something. Because I thought surely she would get something. She's a hardworking, smart, reasonable Republican. I mean,
conundrums all around, Kevin.
Yeah.
But let's go back to that one issue, because a lot of people had campaigned during a primary on the carbon capture pipeline legislation, what became shorthanded as the Landowner Bill of Rights, and this idea of eminent domain. Now, last week on the program, I asked Lieutenant Governor Van Huysen about that, and he said, something on the line of, is that people weren't really opposed to pipelines with eminent domain in general. They just didn't like this carbon capture pipeline because they didn't think it fit that parameters of a public utility, what have you. Very astute listener emailed and said, you really should have followed up, Lori, on that question, because, Keystone XL, no DAPL. Clearly, this state is very engaged in eminent domain going forward. So my question to you is, do you think that the eminent domain bill was unique to the carbon capture pipeline project, or do you think that we will continue to have more robust conversations in the public space and in the state house on concepts of projects and how they're built in people's backyards?
Eminent domain has always been somewhat controversial, depending on the individual pipeline or whatever. But I think carbon it makes me a little more nervous than some of the other ones do. Keystone XL was controversial in part because it was the sands, the tar sands type stuff, and it had to travel at such a heated, temperature and all that kind of stuff. But, this stuff is great if it doesn't leak and that something doesn't happen, and it's a great idea to sequester it, and I think all of that's wonderful. But I think everybody's kind of spooked about that. Now, does that ring across society in South Dakota? I don't think it does. I think it's mostly a landowner issue and certain landowners and some environmental advocates. But it's not going away, that's for sure.
It's not going anywhere. I think all of that is right. I think if you look at it on a primary election level, I think it gets sweeped into a lot of other issues that gets to be covered. this is a real West River perspective of it. Not one of these pipelines is going to be out West River. Yet, look at all these Facebook groups talking about pipelines and eminent domain, and, you know, it has nothing to do with it. But it gets used as the tugboat for the rest of the nonsense.
Okay, let's go back a little bit on that. Because if you were, you know, advising the pipeline company and you're sitting around saying, what went wrong here for them, for the people who are trying to build? Where did they misstep?
I didn't watch this, but some people that I know who were involved in it said that even the proponents of the pipeline thought the company handled it poorly.
Yeah,
agree.
And I think they would tell you that
they'd take a mulligan if you give it to them now. I think yeah, too, if you looked so. At them in the mirror, right?
Yeah, you talk about legislators coming back in a second year. Maybe they've learned something. I would think those folks that want to build that thing would say, "We didn't do that very well."
Yeah, anybody who wants to build anything is going to have a lesson from how they appeared in the press with the number of landowners that were coming forward and saying we were not treated respectfully.
Yeah.
Hindsight being 2020, I mean, because it's easy for us to sit there and go, oh, yeah, they'd like a mulligan. But, you know, it's just the issue of the moment. There was a land swell of presidential voters that were, you got a Narcan, Ohio every 4 years to pick a president, as I've heard a comedian say once.
You got
right?
What?
You get a Narcan, Ohio to pick a president every year. So again, pipeline was the tugboat. There was a bunch of people who aren't really that politically engaged while the session is on, all of a sudden being forced to be engaged through the social media. It builds a lot of false narrative of what is actually driving the conversation. It could have just as easily been a packing plant or a TIF for a district or a local community municipal county race. They're all the same. Nobody can catch up to the 40-person Facebook group that has six-month head start of misinformation.
But we just said
outspend it.
Misinformation aside, we just said engagement is a good thing. And engagement is how things get done.
It's important. And I'm assuming in this case that the horrible behavior of the company has been exaggerated in some cases.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I read some of those stories and said, really? They actually did that?
Right.
And maybe they did.
I guess one of my points here is that, you know, you can pick and choose the issues that you like and say, well, we're so happy that everybody called in, wrote in, had coffee with their legislators. Mm-hmm. And then there's an issue that maybe is less, you know, something that you might dislike. And then you say it's crazy people on Facebook.
Yeah, sure. I know. Well, that's
I don't know, you guys.
That's super
yeah.
fair. Yeah. But, you know, pick
engagement
the topic.
Works. And you
prison,
know,
yeah. pipeline, mm-hmm. school education. It's hard to find the divining rod of accuracy through all of those issues.
That's podcast host Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen and journalist Kevin Wooster. They stepped into the Dakota Political Junkies roles today. You can find this conversation and more on SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies podcast feed. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. 2025 marked South Dakota's 100th legislative session. Now, we couldn't find any political reporters who have been involved in every one of those sessions, but we did catch up with journalist Bob Mercer. Mercer has covered or participated in every session since 1985, and that is 40 years of South Dakota politics. Mercer is now the State Capitol Bureau reporter with Kelloland Media Group. He has been a longtime presence in the Capitol as a journalist and as former Governor Bill Janklow's press secretary. I connected with Bob Mercer via Zoom.
I grew up in Wisconsin and in a town of about 5,000 people, and I delivered the daily newspaper. It was a 5 day a week paper, and I delivered that, and I started when I was about 10 and did it for a few years and then moved on.
And did you have an idea at that age that there was something in the news, something that was in the newspaper, or something that people made it, or were you just a kid on a bike essentially?
Well, I was a kid on a bike, but you know, my mom was a big newspaper reader. And so at our house, we didn't have much money, but we got the Milwaukee Journal in the afternoon and the local daily in the afternoon. And then we also subscribed to the weekly newspaper of our hometown. And then, so I had a lot to read. And My mom also got another paper off and on as, you know, as times changed.
Yeah. When did you start reading the newspaper and finding relevance for your own life?
Oh, probably when I was sitting on the back porch of the what we called the agency. The we went to a house to get our papers to deliver. And so before we'd head out on our bikes, we'd sit around and read the paper.
Oh.
It was kind of a fun time. And you'd skim through and you'd look for names. And in the local weekly, sometimes I was a decent student, so sometimes my name would be in there. And yeah. So, yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
You mentioned to me before that you read The Power Broker and learned from the great writer Robert Caro about the importance of the documentary Turn Every Page about Bob Gottlieb and Bob Caro, the importance of looking at every piece of information you can. Tell me a little bit about the influence of Robert Caro's work on and who you are as a journalist.
I mean, what Robert Caro pointed out in the book, The Power Broker, was it was his doorstop of a book. Mm-hmm. About Robert Moses. And he was, I guess, for lack of a better term, the director of public works in New York City. But he was much more than that. And what he did when he was a legislator, before he became the director of public works, was he would piece together different bills in the legislature. And one bill could build upon another. And so what it taught me was I needed to read every bill to get to know what was going on, but B, to see if there were any patterns of legislators who were building their own little empires, if you will,
yeah,
you know, legislatively.
Yeah. It is a book about how power works. And
it is.
And you learn from it how to watch and how to report and how to hold power accountable by paying attention to that. Do I understand you correctly?
And the other thing I learned from Robert Caro himself was just the importance of, you know, as you say, turning every page, reading every page. And so the book, The Power Broker, it's hundreds, I mean, many hundreds of pages, but he goes in, he documents all of Moses's life and from the time that he would walk out on an island and look and could envision the beaches he was going to build there and things like that. And then the freeways that he built through the city of New York and the housing that he built in the city of New York and the areas that he ran those projects through and what they were before and how the neighborhoods changed after those projects came through. And it was often not for the better. For those neighborhoods,
yeah.
For the city of New York, it was probably for the better, but for those neighborhoods, it was not for the better.
Right, right. Do you remember your first legislative session in South Dakota? I know that's jumping ahead a bit, and we might go back and talk about some of your other formative experiences, but do you remember the first time? Yeah.
Yeah, 1985. I lived in Aberdeen at that time. I came down for the session. I stayed at the Thrifty Scott Motel, which had plaid carpets, hence the name, or vice versa, I don't know which. But at the time, I used a manual typewriter and wrote my stories by hand when I got back to my hotel room and then called the desk at the Aberdeen American News and dictated my stories via phone. And there were no laptops in those days. And you know, we had the old AP teletype machines clattering in the newsroom and things like that. So it was a much different time.
You know, I legitimately miss those machines. I was saying the other day that, you know, when I read the news now on my phone, even though I'm reading in a newspaper, I might be looking at the app, the newspaper's app on my phone. I'm like, I never know when I'm done, right? Whereas with a newspaper or a broadcast, you know, if I watch Kello TV, I know when the broadcast has ended. I know when I have finished everything I want to read in the newspaper. And the teletype, you knew when something was coming in that was breaking. And now in my brain, it just seems like it's on all the time, 24/7. And I don't know when it's done.
Well, Twitter is the same way or worse. I mean, it's, and I use Twitter, but yeah, it's a crazy world it's changed into.
Do you remember your first big story, your first, big breaking news at that time in Pierre?
In 1986, I looked into the political action committees that gave money to influence, at that time, telephone deregulation. Okay. That was a hot issue at that time. Bell Telephone was Northwestern Bell was the telephone provider in South Dakota for all of the communities, or most of the communities of any size. And they were fighting in the legislature about that. And Northwestern Bell wanted to be deregulated, if you will. And others didn't want them to deregulate. And so I looked into who spent money, and it was primarily Northwestern Bell's PAC spent money to influence legislators to get them to vote for deregulation. Huh. And there had been no real spending before that by Northwestern Bell, and there was no real spending after that by Northwestern Bell. So it was a first lesson in how money can influence politics.
All right. What makes a good story in state politics? How do you know? I mean, we all have to do as reporters. We're always doing stories to meet deadlines. When do you know that you've got your hands on something that's just a plain good story?
That's a hard question. Anything that the governor does is probably newsworthy, And then you have to, I don't know, one thing I look at is who sponsors, when I'm covering legislation, I look at who sponsors pieces of legislation. And you just get to kind of know who has the political muscle, if you will, to get a bill through and who doesn't. And you just learn that from watching on the ground. And on the other hand, and I'll give you a recent example. There was a bill a year ago, Senate Bill 201, which would have changed a lot of land. It would have put a lot of landowner protections in for people who are going to have carbon dioxide pipelines and other pipelines or transmission facilities run through their land. But the bill also changed a provision, and it was a tiny provision, and how the Public Utilities Commission worked with local ordinances. And so the old law that was in place was that the commission might override those local ordinances. Mm-hmm. And the Senate Bill 201 said that the permit from the PUC shall override those local ordinances. And that law got referred. And then last November, the voters overturned that new law. And the voters also went out and elected a whole bunch of new legislators and kicked out a whole bunch of the incumbents who had voted for that law. And so that one little clause in that one law really changed the makeup of our legislature, and it changed our entire leadership of the legislature this year. And it also then led to a bill coming through this year that the new governor has now signed into law that prohibits carbon dioxide pipelines from using eminent domain to force their way across people's land. So that became a big story. And at the time, I couldn't see that coming. I don't think anybody saw it coming. But it became a story, and it had, giant repercussions that'll continue to last for several years yet now.
Yeah. One word, one clause has created this ongoing story. I love how you express that. Is there a part of you that looks for the next story because of what you think is going to happen? Or is that a way for reporters to go down the wrong path? Like, I thought that was going to happen and it didn't, and therefore I missed what really happened. I'm trying to get at this idea of like how much of your work is I'm observing it, I'm following it, I'm tracking it down, and how much of it is yeah, I understand what's going to happen next because of my experience and my insight.
Yeah, predict the future. Okay. That's one thing I've really learned in this is don't try to predict the future.
That's good advice. I think that's good advice in general. Yeah. One of the things I'd like to ask you, just as someone who does a daily radio show and does multiple interviews a day, I look at your body of work and I wonder, how do you keep track of it all? Because sometimes I have a hard time, obviously, keeping track of it all. Information management. Do you have files? Is it all in your head? Do you keep all your old notebooks? How are you tracking the information? Because I'm guessing it's not all digital.
It's not.
Thank goodness for me, because that's what I want to hear.
No, it's not. But, you know, every couple of years I clean out my office and that's when I have to make decisions then. Am I ever going to crack this notebook again?
Yeah.
And if I say it, if I decide it's not, it goes in the garbage bag. And the other thing is that I take a lot of notes now on my laptop in a meeting as opposed to writing on paper. And so that's, you know, that's another way things have changed, but, you know, heaven help me if my laptop ever goes down, you know, and as far as video, what I do is, once the video is transmitted to Keloland, I can wipe it off my computer. So I don't have to keep those files at all. But you know, one of the things I learned from, well, like, you know, a couple of guys who covered the Capitol here with me through the years, Chet Brokaw with the Associated Press, great, great reporter. Terry Wooster with the Argus Leader was a great, great reporter. Kevin Wooster, who worked for a number of news organizations, including public broadcasting. Yes. He was a great reporter. And you know, they each had their way of doing things, and so I'd kind of would steal from them, you know. You know, what did they do that I liked, and what did they do that I didn't like? And so I took the ideas that I liked, and I didn't take the ideas that I didn't like, and kind of made my own custom way of doing things.
Yeah. When you took a turn as a press secretary for Governor Bill Janklow, were there things that you learned being on the other side of this that you carry with you as a journalist now?
Yeah, I sure do. You know, I grew up in a family of deer hunters.
Okay.
And when I worked for Bill Janklow, I learned what it was like to be the deer. I say that in all seriousness. It was a learning. But, you know, one of the things when I went to so. I'll tell you quickly. The reason I went to work for Bill Janklow was he recruited me, and it was at the end of his third term. He had just won re-election to a fourth term as governor. He couldn't run for governor again, and at the same time, Tom Daschle was the U.S. Senate Democratic leader at the time. Those two guys got along well, And I just thought, you know, this is a time to maybe go do this. And at the time, Janklow's office, in terms of its press relations, just wasn't functional. Mm-hmm. As a reporter, we'd call and want to interview Janklow, and you'd get a call back 6 weeks or 2 months later, what do you want to talk about? And well, that was a story 6 weeks ago. It's long past, you know. When I went to work there, his administrative staff would stand at a fax machine and punch in the numbers, the individual numbers for each news outlet, one at a time. And so they would spend hours just distributing one news release. And so a guy who was on Janklow's staff at that time named Mike Mueller. He became my, co-worker, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so what he and I worked out were some arrangements where Mike would work with the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications, the state government's technology arm, if you will, on bringing in technology. And so at the same time that I would work on just writing news releases, and one of the things I learned with Janklow was I couldn't get him to call people back very often. But if I walked around with a notepad and I wrote down whatever he said on a topic that seemed quotable, then when a reporter called and wanted to talk to him, I could say, well, I don't know if I can get him to call you back, but here's what he said, and I'll tell you when he said it, and it worked well.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And he was fine with that. So what we built up, I thought we had one of the best press operations in America for a governor's office at that time, and that was 25 years ago. But we put out news releases. We would do call-ins where if he wanted to announce something, we would arrange an open call-in for reporters. And so at 10 o'clock or 9:30 in the morning, we would have an open line, and they'd call in, and he would answer all their questions. I mean, he'd make some kind of announcement and then answer the questions about that announcement. And then if he had time and you wanted to ask him about something else off topic, you could. I mean, he loved to talk and we put out something, the Weekly Planner. We called it News Tips. Mm-hmm. so that you knew what was coming in the week ahead, not only from the governor's office, but throughout state government. And we got other department secretaries to do the call-ins as well. They were reluctant at first, but once they saw they weren't going to get their heads bit off, they were okay with it. And then we also put out what were called issue papers. And so we would take something complicated, like say the school aid formula. Mm-hmm. And we would explain it, and it would take multiple pages to explain because it's a highly intricate thing. Mm-hmm. But then we didn't have to walk through it with every reporter every time. And we could refer them. We'd say, look at the issue brief on the school aid formula, and then call back if you have some more questions. And so we could economize our time better that way and manage our time better that way.
Yeah.
So we even figured out simple things that how to get news on the air for a longer period by the timing of when you do the news release. And so if what we did was we would hold a news conference at 9:30 or 9:45 in the morning, so that the TV people were on the job, but the radio people, the morning reporters, were through their morning newscast, and so there's kind of a sweet time right in there where we could get all the print, the TV, and the radio people all together, and then we knew that whatever we had to announce would be on the news for the evening and the next morning.
Yeah.
And then, and so it just, I mean, so we understood how to manage a news cycle and
versus the 4:30 PM on a Friday.
Yeah, exactly. And we didn't do that. Why is that a thing now? Well, I think it's always a way to get bad news out. They think it's going to be ignored,
Sure.
It's going to be overridden on the weekend and people aren't paying attention. Yeah, I mean, we wanted attention.
Yeah.
And Janklow wanted attention. And right. So that's what we did. But, and then he wanted me to go to Washington with him. So then he decided to run for the U.S. House.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't have any part of this. I just didn't. And that changed everything. And I went in that campaign office exactly twice. Once was the first night when they opened it up and they gave out keys to everybody. And I gave my key back. And I just said, I'm not going to be here. And then the other time I went in, somebody gave me an envelope when I was out, and said to get this to Jim Hagan. And so I delivered that message, and then that was it. Otherwise, I never set foot in there.
Yeah.
So,
huh. What was your worst day on the job? What comes to mind?
Janklow?
No, in your career. Well, as a reporter or with Janklow?
Well, you know, I quit Janklow once.
Okay.
So, yeah. It was right before the dedication of the World War II Memorial. And what we had worked out was the Newspaper Association was going to put in all of the papers statewide, weeklies and dailies, a preprint that would have the history of South Dakotans in World War II. Mm-hmm. And Janklow wanted to have the last word on what went in there. And I kept sending him the pages, or, you know, sending him the copy, and it just wasn't getting done. And so finally, John Hunter over at the Madison Daily Leader, who was going to print it, was like, we got to have that. We got to have that, Bob. And I said, I can't move it. And so finally, that was on a Thursday, and I quit. And on Monday, the Twin Towers got hit and the Pentagon got hit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I went back to work. Yeah. So, so anyway, and in the meantime, he had gotten the preprint done. So, but it was a sad dedication of the World War II Memorial.
Wow.
And times changed. That 9/11 changed so much in America and throughout the world. I mean, it changed our capital. You know, the Capitol used to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You signed a note, just signed a book that you were there, if you were there on Saturdays or Sundays. And, you know, and now they lock all the doors. You can only come in during business hours through one set of doors. You go through a metal detector. You know, there's cameras everywhere now. You know, the legislative process changed too during that time, but we now have a iron 8 foot high fence around the governor's mansion,
right,
to keep people away, yeah, who shouldn't be there or, you know, might be there. I mean, we now have security who travel with the governor,
right,
anywhere he or she goes, you know, and yeah, lots of things have changed.
Yeah.
Because of that.
That is State Capitol Bureau reporter for Keloland News, Bob Mercer. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.